Sometimes dead is better.
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 Sometimes dead is better. And that's what Bill Betterman didn't know. That sometimes dead is better.
Because it's just like, dude, really, you have no power in this situation. But that baby managed to flip an entire truck.
Right. Hey, it's a baby that's being guided into the road by, you know, evil twigs. Sorry, I keep calling it that. It's the spirit, the Wendigo from.
The movie specifically tries very hard to, although it's an Indian burial ground, they step away from the folklore really fast, and I think it's a PC move, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
And the only time they reference the Wendigo is the sound in the woods, so they must reference it much more in the book. But they poorly, unfortunately, allude to this spiritual drive. Like later on, Judd is going to say that he's the cause of this,
right?
Because of him drawing in this spirity thing. But it just looks like an accident.
Baby flips a semi, and we get a dramatic no.
No,
it's not the only one in the movie, by the way.
And then we have a family photo. No montage is what I called it.
As he's saying no, we get these flashes of pictures. And then it transitions into Lewis looking at one of the pictures at his kitchen table.
Yeah. Okay, so I go straight from that to the funeral.
Oh, okay.
Is there something in between the no and photo montage?
Yeah.
Oh, there's the holding the picture part.
Yeah. So Ellie comes in and she's like holding the picture and she's like, I can't sleep with mommy because she keeps hogging the covers.
She's sedated, by the way.
Yeah. And Judd says, what do you got there? And
forcefully takes the picture from her.
Yeah. She does not want to show it. In the book, she's like, I'm going to hold on to this picture and I'm going to hold on to Gage's chair. So that way they're ready for him when he gets back. And it's like, it has not sunk in, until the very end of that scene in the book that is, he's not going to come back, Ellie.
Oh, because in the movie, she says, I'm going to hold on to it until God sends him back.
Right. And in the story, she's like, yeah.
She just thinks that he's going to come back.
Yeah.
Well, Dad's like, stop or whatever. And then she dramatically sobs in the other room.
Right. She like runs and face buried into the couch. Dramatic sob.
Yeah. I think he then puts her to bed or something like that.
Yeah. And in the movie, she says, God could take it back if he wanted to.
Dead stare, like scary, the shining stare off into the distance. And he's done it a couple times now because he's super traumatized. Dad is like, well, I guess he could.
Yeah. And then we get a smash cut to the funeral where Erwin Goldman is talking to a guy who just lost his kid. Erwin Goldman.
Yeah.
Oh, and this is one of those moments where I was just like, this transition was so abrupt. It felt like when Ellie was talking to Lewis after they visited the pet cemetery. And again, this was one of those things where you could have had like a nice solid like 30 seconds of just Lewis sitting in the front of the pew.
Like building up to the drama, like an entrance of the brother or whatever.
Yeah.
Instead, it's
like, you just, where were you when he was playing out in the middle of the road?
He was the only one running towards his child.
Oh, and Goldman goes ahead one step further, said, I told Rachel this was going to happen if she married you.
Nothing but misery or something like that.
Right. And I'm like, why would you blame your daughter at the funeral? And, you know, he does this. He doesn't do it at the funeral. They kind of have an exchange. Oh, they do. They have like a dinner and they have exchange of words. But it's just like, you know, I told Rachel that this was going to happen because she married you.
This is happening after.
It's happening before the funeral. And then it's at the funeral where they actually have the rough and tumble. And yeah, it's just like,
my notes are just questions after this point. It's like, who screams at the parent at a child's funeral.
I know.
Who lets the fight continue after it's broken out at a funeral?
Who attacks the parent, falls into the coffin.
Whose mustache asks the dad what's wrong with him when he's the one getting attacked? And then shoving happens and he gets pushed into the coffin.
Oh, you were like literally, it wasn't like a rhetorical question. You were actually wondering who that guy was.
I don't care who that is. But I do want, if you know, I want to know.
I don't know the guy's name off the top of my head, but in the book, it's like Lewis's friend and colleague. And like at the very end of the book, you see things from his perspective and he's just like, what the f- is going on?
I love views from the outside.
No, and then he was
because
like,
because it's like the thing where Romeo and Juliet is not a romantic tale. It's a romance between a 14 and a 16 year old that ends with six dead.
I know.
Over 3 days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so this guy is just sort of like, he's there as, he's like really the only person that we see outside of the family who is, Lewis's support structure out. And, you know, I would say Judd is kind of there because Lewis, calls Judd the closest thing to a father because Lewis doesn't really have a lot of respect for his father. And at least that's the way it's kind of brought up in the book. But like Judd is kind of the harbinger of doom in some ways, even if it's unbeknownst to him. Mm-hmm. So this guy,
you're exactly, yeah, right, by the way. The director actually makes that point. She says that Pascal is the, mm-hmm, good angel,
yeah,
on the shoulder, and that Judd is the bad angel on the other shoulder.
Yeah.
And that I think holds to be true. I made a mistake earlier, and now he puts her to bed, I think, after the funeral. Mom is sedated. He checks on her, kisses her.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And now that whole thing that was true, we said it before, I just accidentally bumped it up in my notes.
Yeah, and Lewis, you know, gets a knock at the door. Judge shows up.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're thinking about. And, of course, we have to go through this whole friggin' scene where basically Judd's like, oh, you shouldn't do that. And he's like, all right, he's in shock drinking.
Right.
Solid liquor this time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I don't even know what you're talking about. And he's just like, can't do it. And then he talks about this time that somebody did do it back in the day. Mm-hmm. And so my questions are, does it really matter how long they've been dead? Because this guy died in a war, presumably because it was this century, like, not this century now. This is in the
last century.
This is World War II, I assume.
Yeah.
This guy dies and that
Timmy Bateman.
And it was a foreign war. So it wouldn't have happened here. So that body, and I don't know how long it takes. I don't even know how long in World War II it would have taken to ship a body back, but I assume more than a week.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they bury him up on the burial grounds and he comes back. And now my question is this a zombie movie, Lydia?
I mean, in the movie, it seems that way because Timmy Baderman is like eating some fleshy arm thing.
Yeah. And there's some bitiness later on, but mm-hmm. I mean, isn't it classic? And they go to great lengths to make it look like there's this thoughtful spirit mm-hmm. mucking around. And
yeah.
By thoughtful, I just mean like consciously trying to screw with people thing going on.
Yeah. I can tell you in the book,
mm-hmm.
Timmy Baderman wasn't a zombie,
mm.
but he was more like this Wendigo spirit who just saw the dead body as more like an empty vessel. And when in the book, when they actually confront to take care of Timmy Baderman, then there's a little bit more reason than it just was, you know, it was just wrong that they had to take care of him. But when they go to confront him, Timmy Baderman's dad is just like, I don't know, like just acting like it's not that big of a deal. And Timmy like just turns around and looks at all of them and pretty much just says, I know all of your shit. And I'm going to talk about your shit. And Judd's whole point was it just only focused on the bad stuff. Because even though these guys, you know, didn't really have as much money as maybe they should have, or maybe they, you know, cheated on their wives or that sort of stuff, these were like good people. These were good people who like, you know, made sure that jobs got made. And I can't remember all of it, all of the little finer details. But Judd's whole point is this thing, whatever it was not willing to focus on good things. It just focused on the bad stuff that they did.
And it just called them out on it?
Yeah. And
so did they end up burning him down like they burned down this guy in this film?
No, the dad actually took out
his kid. Oh, by
the
way, we're in a flashback. We're in Judd's flashback, by the way.
So in the book, it's not them that burn down the house. It's the dad who ends up like killing his son and burning down and then killing himself and burning him and burning both of them in the house.
Which is how this should have ended.
Right.
Personal opinion.
Yeah.
Okay. That's fine. But this is where we get the thing that goes over. Okay. First of all, I wrote down, it's got to be more convincing in the book. And it sounds like it was.
Oh, yeah, for this area, yeah.
And then I totally agree with the burn it all down mentality, because when stuff gets too real, burn it all down.
Yeah, and don't know if you noticed this in the movie, but there were, like, moments where Timmy Baderman was, like, talking with his dad, like, saying some, like, kind of... He wasn't, like, moans and groans.
No, he was using words.
Yeah, and then, like, while they were burning...
I didn't catch any of those words.
I did not catch any of them either, but it seemed like there was some consciousness there, and it wasn't necessarily, like, a villainous consciousness. It was just, like, in the movie, it seemed more like they were talking about, you know... We got to take care of this guy because it just wasn't right. And that was real.
And they quote, actually, they quote Frankenstein in like the let's burn it thing.
Yeah.
I didn't write it down either. I'm terrible. But it's very much like the kill the monster.
Yeah.
And okay. So we end on the thing that is said. He says it three times and I'm going to give it to you because I like your accent better.
Oh, the soil of a man's heart, Estonia.
No. Well, yeah, he does say that. He does say the soil of a man's heart, Estonia. But okay. He also says... Sometimes dead is better.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
He says it like three times.
Yeah. Okay. I will say that.
Sometimes dead is better.
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 Sometimes dead is better. And that's what Bill Betterman didn't know. That sometimes dead is better. Do you know, Lewis, that sometimes dead is better? Did I say that? I was... Go ahead and say it again.
Dead is better.
Sometimes dead is better. Dead better is. I can say that like Yoda, so that way you understand it.
Better. Sometimes dead is.
That's great. So, Judd says dead is better for like the 500th time, and...
Let's get these guys to the airport.
Lewis sees Rachel and Ellie off, which, why is Rachel going home... with her parents after her dad pretty much accused her of being the reason her son died?
She accused him of being the reason her son died.
Yeah, but he also said, I told Rachel that this kind of thing would happen if she married you.
Yeah, but that leaves her innocent in his eyes. A parent is nearly always going to side with their child.
I don't know.
Especially in the midst of tragedy. You find somebody to blame and you just kind of go with it.
Yeah, okay, so... I don't know. I mean, I would probably not go with my dad if he just accused my husband of being the reason why our son died. I would be like, no, I'm not going to go there. I'm going to stay put right here because, yeah.
Well, it's just saying that he was reacting in the moment at the funeral because we cut so quick between scenes. There's really no time to build that relationship that you described earlier in the book with the dinner and over a period of time, right?
Right.
So we go to the airport. The little girl, mom, going to grandma, grandpa's. He's going to stay back and figure stuff out. But he's been doing the dead stare since the baby died.
Yeah.
So he's got something percolating in the crazy centers of his brain. So when grandpa tries to like smooth things over and he goes.
He does that like the like limp hand.
Oh, yeah. He gives him like the super dead fish hand. The father is like, he goes, I'm sorry. What can I say? I lost my mind.
And then he's just sort of like.
He hands out and the guy puts his hands out and just kind of like blah, 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 blah.
I don't really care right now.
He goes, we all lost our minds, Erwin. And he's doing the dead stare at the same time.
Yeah.
And he's already handed the bag to Rachel and he squats down and he says goodbye to Ellie. And Ellie's like, don't go down. She has this very passionate pleading voice that grates me like level 65 sandpaper.
It doesn't bother me.
I'd rather the little boy have every line and have it be the three words he knows how to say.
Oh, yeah. That would be fun. Because he's super adorable.
McLean with and it's Lucy speaking.
Throwback to Die Hard. Go listen to it if you haven't.
Yeah. And so they get on the airplane. They go back to Chicago.
I had a dream about a guy named Pelsko. He said that that's going to do something really bad. She's saying this to Grandma Grip as Rachel and Lewis are saying goodbye to each other. And then nobody listens to her. She's right every time. I know she's psychic in the book, but only her dreams are mentioned in this movie. Mm-hmm. And every time she says it, she's right. And I mean, how many times would a kid have to be right about something like this before you're like, you know what? Let's ask her what, you know, we should have breakfast every morning and discuss what Ellie dreamed about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think if she had said it to her dad, like, I had a dream about some guy named Pascal. Pacow.
Yeah, she says it wrong. And so they never notice.
Right. But I don't know if they would have noticed if she had mentioned that name to her dad, the guy who's been seeing the dead guy who, you know, he would have known the name.
Mm-hmm.
Then maybe it would have been something where he was like,
no, we haven't seen Pacow since the wandering sequence.
Right.
The moonlit walk with the dead guy.
Yeah.
You know, 2 or 5 episodes ago. Not episodes, but
two or five parts ago. 2 or 5 months ago.
Yeah, maybe. But okay, so they're off. They plead with him to go, but he refuses. He's got stuff to do. And my notes are like, all right, let's dig up a dead kid.
Yeah, and he drives over.
And then and no one will notice.
He drives his car, parks it next to the fence, and then he like throws some digging tools over the fence, and then he goes over the fence, and then he like nestles up next to his son's grave that has all these flowers.
So many flowers.
And then he sees Pacow saying,
like, don't do it, man.
Don't unleash what's over there. And
remember, the fold must not be like walk past or something. He's just like, the ground is sour.
Yeah. And Lewis is like, no, it's okay. If it doesn't work, then I'll just go ahead and kill him. But you don't know if you're gonna do that because you've never had to deal with this before. And you see like the inconsistencies in this movie. There's like, you know, no more, there's like one little thing of flowers.
It had been the gravestone, which only says Cage Creed on it, which is sad because like he'd put the dates or whatever, or much beloved child, or his voice was so cute we should have cut out all of his sister's dialogue. But like they're surrounded by blue and white flowers. It cuts to Pacow, the love of my movie, and then it cuts back to dad, and there's only like one handful of yellow daisies.
Mm-hmm.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
We cut, I think this scene is, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's intercut with Ellie having a dream and her mom rescuing her, right?
Yes. It's light out, by the way.
Well, Chicago is different than Maine time-wise, right?
Well, that could be true. Like, if it would have been, like, 7 in Maine, then it probably would have been, like, 6 or 5
no,
or
I think
6.
No, I think it's only about an hour.
Yeah.
If it's any maybe different. But here's the thing. I'm over here, and it doesn't change. I don't travel enough. I don't have one of those watches with multiple faces on it. I have a phone that switches. When I switch it time zones, it switches for me because I live in the future and this is 1989.
Right.
Okay. So, but when we pan from the hallway and we are listening on the conversation of Ellie and her mom, and it's like, his dad's going to do something awful. We got to, and she's like, you're just having a dream. But we pan past all these photos, and this is the moment it occurred to me in the film that there are hundreds of background photos for this film. There's school photos, baby photos, ancestry photos, wedding photos, first birthday photos, sailor uniform photos, school photos, like, there are so many photographs in this film.
Mm-hmm. There's also this picture, and I forgot about it.
Okay, so you're going to bring up the portrait.
So when Rachel is talking about Zelda's death, there is this moment where she's running through the house, and the camera lingers on this picture of a kid in a blue outfit with a top hat, a whip, and a gray cat.
A gray cat. But let me tell you, it's a portrait. It is her sister as a youth. Before the spinal meningitis kicked in.
I believe it's pronounced Ute.
It is Ute. Ute, when I'm not the Native American tribe, but me mispronouncing youth in a way that I thought was charming for a long time, but now I realize is really irritating.
No. Keep it. It's podcast lore at this point.
Yeah? Okay. So it was her sister Zelda as a Ute. And this can be confirmed by the foreshadowing of the yellow. God help me. The gray cat, which is an English short hair, not a Russian blue, and certainly not a Maine Coon. Maine Coons are like 25 pounds.
No, that makes sense.
Okay. Everybody thinks it's a Russian blue, though, but it's an English short hair. I looked it up. I didn't. It was on Wikipedia. So, nope, it was on IMDb.
That is so creepy that it, not that it was an English short hair, but the fact that it is Zelda in that outfit.
It's the dress. It's the red hair. It's also a foreshadowed top hat. And we can debate the whip and the cane part, the disparity between the two.
Yeah, but the fact that the cat's there, I mean, this is something that's obviously in their life. The outfit that Zelda is wearing in the flashback is very reminiscent of it. So it makes sense that it would be, you know, referencing it.
Mm-hmm. Plus also the Wendigo slash not Wendigo of this movie is supposed to be messing with... King does this again and again. He takes the thing that will mess with you the most and he implants it in this other thing that's supposed to terrify you. So when the kiddo comes back... how is he going to terrify his mom the most?
Right.
That's why the foreshadowing is there. Okay, right. So this is part of my notes where it says, the kids are always smarter than the parents in King's stuff.
Yeah.
And also I wrote down the word discorporated because I knew I'd forget it.
Yeah.
He told me he was going to help Dad because he was there when Dad was disc. Oh, I can't remember. And I'm like, oh, God.
I still find her adorable.
She's not even, like, a blonde or anything.
Oh, yeah. When Julie Brown's like, it's a part you sang.
Because I'm blonde?
Yeah, but it's the I can't remember thing.
Because I'm a, oh, I don't know.
A B-L-O-N. I don't remember. Yeah. That's terrible.
So
we're never gonna get to the end. We live here now.
Mm-hmm. We're just gonna get buried behind the pet cemetery. But I'm going
to school to be a
veterinarian because veterinarian I love children.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So mom walks out of the room after she's like, I can't remember. And Pascal is behind her. And they do. I love this. I love Pascal. We already know. But. Did you know that his prosthetic was so good that whenever he was on set, nobody would eat lunch with him? Because they thought it was so gross. Okay, I love that. I want to be Pascal's friend because I could totally sit next to a, like an uncovered brain and just like totally eat a craft service dinner. Okay, so she walks out. She's like staring off. She's getting thoughtful. She's like, oh, maybe I should take my distressed, traumatized daughter's worries into consideration. And, what was that name, Pascal? And he's like, Pasco. And she's like, oh, Pasco? Mm-hmm. And then she's like, Disc. What does she mean? And then he goes, he does a close-up of his face and he goes, discorporated. And she was like, oh, shit. Like, she knows what that word means. And now I'm going to have to Google what it means right now because I don't remember. I know it's probably the moment your soul separates from your body, but maybe there's a better definition.
Well, that's kind of how they put it in the book, so.
What is it?
Discorporated.
I'm already doing it.
Not having a material body, bodiless ghosts,
disembodied, unembodied, unbodied, incorporeal, immaterial,
without material forms or substance, an incorporeal spirit.
Okay, I kind of feel like a third wheel officially at this point.
Because we both have Apple products and it pulled up the exact same thing when we tried to beat each other to the definition.
I have an Android.
I don't know what you're talking about. I Googled Bing and I got DuckDuckGo results. And
well,
there you
I
are.
Asked Jeeves, and he thinks that you're DuckDuckGoats.
DuckDuckGoats.
Well, I posted my results to GeoCities before anybody else did.
Well, that's all right. Mike from MySpace liked my status update.
How did you even know that? Didn't even have notifications back then. No, didn't even have notifications.
Oh, I wasn't notified. I checked it when I used my dial-up.
Okay.
Can we just go back?
Okay. Rachel is like, she figures out maybe something is wrong and I need to call home.
She gasps next to this portrait that we just described that we'd seen in the flashback from when her sister died.
And she goes and she calls home, but Lewis isn't there.
He's too busy digging up their child.
And there's a cop that shows up.
He's like peeking like prairie dog style over the side of the pit.
The cop goes away and has this expression like I just farted and nobody knows it's me.
Like the guy in the room who was just like, does anybody smell popcorn? And then waits for all of his friends to gag.
I would like, if I may, to just break for a moment to not just return your average top result about a definition, but if we're going to use this word in our podcast, we can't just provide a definition. We should provide it in a sentence.
Is that Urban Dictionary?
This is the official UrbanDictionary.com, straight from the law-abiding internets. This is actually Robert Heinlein writing the thoughts of a character, Valentine Michael Smith in Stranger in the Strange Land.
I'm just power through it, Joey. Go for it.
His joy was muted by awareness that his brother did not share it. He seemed more distressed than was possible, save in one about to discorporate because of shameful lack of failure. And that's Stranger in a Strange Land.
My life is the opposite of a shameful lack of failure. I have a very proud abundance of failure.
But so it's not like a discorporate, it's like discorporate. Like you incorporate or you discorporate.
Okay. I'm super into it.
There's your educational.
Okay. So, why don't you just say like separate the soul when his soul was separated from his body? See, that seems very universal to know. Like everybody's gonna know what the word separate means. I did not know
we
what
don't
discorporate
know, we means. Don't know what her job was, if she ever had one.
Right.
So maybe she was an English teacher.
That's true.
And this is totally her bag. And she was like, giant word that means something?
Maybe after her sister died, her parents decided to go ahead and, you know, give her anything she wanted, you know, outside of therapy.
Well, so...
Maybe up in Maine, they discorporate all day long. Maybe they discorporate lobsters. And that's how it's done.
We're going to discorporate this lobster flesh from its shell.
You know how like in animes, like that somebody will be like super distraught and then their like spirit is like half hanging out their body because they feel like dying. So that's it.
It's just their souls hanging over their bodies.
That's discorporation.
Right.
And that's how I feel right now. Okay. So she's freaked out. She calls home. She's like, hey, Crandall.
Yeah, when she can't get a hold of Lewis, she calls Judd, and like this seemed to like last a lot longer in the book. So for me, I was like, call Judd. Why aren't you calling Judd? Why aren't you calling Judd? And then she calls Judd. I was like, thank you. At this point, I was like listening to the book as I'm driving, and I'm like screaming at it.
Well, here's the thing. He's like, well, I'll tell him you're worried if he comes over.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, no, I'm coming home. And he's like,
don't do it.
Because he knows he can tell what's going to happen. Right.
Yeah.
And he just
weasel.
He sits on his couch and drinks a beer for the fifth freaking time in this film. He has one beer, falls asleep, misses dude coming home with his kid's dead body, passes him, goes up into the hills to bury it.
Do you want to know what my note is?
What?
It's in all caps. So I'm going to say it far away from the mic. It should have been coffee. Like, if you know you're going to have to stay up late, do you drink a beer?
No.
Yeah, I drink coffee. If I think I'm going to have to be like at that point, it's like, I need to be awake. I probably will need to be awake for several hours.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to put on a pot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, he really should have. What he should have done was go over there. Or somehow maintained alertness or went and got him from called the authorities. He should have physically intervened then. But what he does is he falls asleep on his porch waiting for his neighbor to come home.
Right.
And he does.
Right.
And then we don't see him again until it's too freaking late.
Yeah. So Lewis has Gage. He's like cradling him. He pulls him out of his coffin.
Super sad.
Cradles him and everything.
You only ever really see the back of the dummy's head or his hand when it's being re-wrapped up for him to bring home.
Rachel is dreaming of Zelda.
Yeah.
And Zelda says, Cage and I will get you for letting us die.
You'll never get out of bed again. You'll never get out of bed again.
Yeah.
It was terrible. Like, yeah. It was super freaky. I love how squatted down. Andrew, the guy, squatted down and got up in the camera's face. That was very good.
Right. And then she wakes up on a plane and the lady who's sitting next to her is just sort of like, what?
Yeah. And then it cuts to that's the lady on her left side. And on her right side, you see Pascal sitting in what we must assume is an empty seat.
He was so happy.
He's just like, dude, we're on the plane right now. Getting her home somehow. Did it. Pascal did it. He just did it. He did it. Yay, Pascal!
Okay, so at this point, I was like, you know, I think it's great that you're dealing with Rachel, but you're a ghost. Maybe wake up Judd.
Yeah, you could have picked a better person to help right now.
Right. I mean, Judd was the one who was asleep. Rachel was asleep. Why not go ahead and be like, hey, dude, wake up. Lou, you gotta wake up.
I think she is officially the least crazy person in this film right now.
That makes sense.
She's the only one who hasn't, like, been messed up. I mean, the internet surmised that everyone in this film has a bit of The Shining in them, which is a concept that runs through lots of Stephen King books, especially when psychic stuff is involved.
Yes.
And she seems the least inclined to have any of it, except for that the ghost somehow gets through to her a little bit, because she never actually sees Pascal, which is sorry for her, but awesome for me.
Right. But Lewis arrives.
May I interject in just a moment here? Well, I'd just like to note that Pascal, he's my Pedro.
I've already claimed him.
Oh, but you can't.
I didn't claim him as my Pedro. I claimed him as the love of my movie. You're the love of my life. He's the love of my movie.
And is there a third one? Because it's funnier if there's a third one.
And Lydia is my love of this podcast.
Thank you. Okay, almost through.
We're almost through.
Okay, so Lewis arrives with Gage and heads to the burial ground.
Yeah, he's hugging a corpse. He's like headed towards the burial ground. I did when Pascal's smiling like a loony is what I wrote. Smiling like a loony. I got a heart around it in my notes. And then, okay, so we're montaging back and forth between Dad's ascent to the burial grounds and returning to the house and, Mom's return from Chicago. And Pascal is like helping her along the way.
Mm-hmm.
I know the mechanics of burying a thing up on this thing, right? What the mad, like, Home Alone style dash from Chicago to home is, like, super entertaining, especially because Pascal is helping. So, and she's like, she shows up and she goes, Megan, wait! And the lady's like, I can't! And she, like, dashes past her. You know what she says? She says, okay, I'll call the pilot! And my notes underlined okay three times because I was like, okay. I tried to make us do that earlier in this podcast because it happened a little bit before.
Okay. One, two, three.
Okay.
All right. Good guy Pascal making it work.
Yeah. Though he could have just woken up Judd. Never mind.
Then there's this. Okay, so then there's back to him climbing the craggy cliffs above the rock quarry to get to the burial grounds. And then Crandall's face comes out of a pile of rocks in the middle of the water.
It looks like a face comes out of the pile of rocks at the water to scare Lewis. And it looks like Judd Crandall.
Yeah, it does look like Judd's face. So
okay, so let me get this straight. Crandall at the quarry. I'm trying to add as many K's in here as we can, and then I'll just cut it out and make it sound cool.
The quirky outcropping of Crandall at the rock quarry, curiously causing concern for Creed.
In a cemetery. In a catamitary.
Naomi did it better, John. Sorry.
Well, if they're going to misspell it, how do you do it in a podcast? You got to print it, mispronounce it, right? They're in a cemetery.
We should be calling it Pet Cemetery this whole time. Just pet so people
cemetery?
Get the Pet Cemetery?
I was thinking cemetery.
Cemetery? No. Nope.
Oh, okay.
It's not that kind of podcast. Okay, Death Rocks. We did the alliteration thing.
Rachel gets a car.
Okay, so the lady's like, I don't have any cars. We can role play this. I'm sorry, we just don't have any cars left.
Oh, sorry. I can't remember what he says.
He goes, what about the red one with the scratch down the side?
What
about the red one with the scratch down the side? She goes full zombie for a second. She's like, I'll take that one. Okay.
Yeah. And as Rachel's going, driving back home with the car, there's the tire blows and then she's walking.
She's like, what am I going to do? And Pascal's like, it's trying to stop you.
And she's like, what? And she's walking. She goes past a neon lobster sign because mm-hmm. Maine. And then a truck shows up, an Orinco truck.
That's the only kind of truck that goes down that road.
This is less than 24. I'm assuming this is like around 24 hours after they buried her son. And she's just going to go into a truck. I mean, granted, she needs to get there, but I don't know how you feel about that.
There's a 666 on the side of that truck.
Oh.
Just saying.
Good.
I'm not one of those people who's scared of numbers, and I know there's a fancy word for it, but I'm not scared of the number 666. So I'm like, whatever. You think it's tongue-in-cheek funny.
Mm-hmm.
Spoopy, if you will.
The guy is like, hi, you want to come in here?
Hey, babe.
There's a part of me that wants her to, at some point, say, yeah, I'm trying to go home right after my son's funeral. By the way, one of your company drivers killed my son in one of your company cars.
Dude gets home.
May I interject? I found some different phobias of numbers. Specifically, the 666 is.
I knew there's a fancy word for it. I just don't know what it is.
Percussive maintenance.
hexaphobia. Officially, there are two. There are two different official names for the fear of numbers. There's numerophobia, and there is also arithmophobia.
I'm trying to stop you. Come back to Lewis coming home, and the cat looking at him like, "You dumb sh."
And he goes straight to bed,
falls over comedically. That's number five.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Just like face plants right into his bed. And then Rachel shows up, gets out of the truck.
Baby growling entrance happens.
Right.
Okay, my notes are like, okay, there had to be a voice actor who did all of the noises that the little baby wouldn't do. And then they mixed it with all the noises the baby would do. And what you find yourself with, and I'll probably reference it again as we conclude this, but he says things in a very absolutely adorable baby way, and then they try to make it sound creepy, and it just doesn't work.
I know. His kid is way too cute.
Yeah, he really is. Like, imagine everything. If a dude said it to you in the dark with their breath on your neck, you would freeze to death and die. Yeah.
But if a little baby says it in as cute of a voice as Miko Hughes has, you are not going to find that threatening at all.
Yeah. So we see his shadow, and we see his muddy little feet leaving footprints everywhere, and the cat's walking around with him.
You know what's interesting about that shot? One of the earlier shots, you actually see Gage running around, and all you see are his feet and his legs.
His little naked baby legs, yeah. And his little diaper bottom.
And he runs that little, like, lawnmower bubble ball thing.
Pushy toy, yeah.
Yeah, he runs it into, like, boxes. He's like, uh-oh! And now he's grabbing a scalpel from his dad's bag.
Yeah, he goes to his medical bag, finds the exact box, pulls it out, and I'm like, does this kid have supernatural knowledge, or do you let your like 30-month-old baby know where your stuff is?
Is it actually his son, or is there someone else in there?
Oh, right, because it's smarter than the thing. I noted the convenient muddy prints that mm-hmm. come into play three times.
Yeah.
Crandall. Okay, now we can get to Crandall. You gonna die.
Well, yeah, that's what happens when you have beer instead of coffee.
Fall asleep on your porch, and you live in the middle of nowhere where people have been walking into each other's houses this whole time. And he kind of snaps awake. He hears a noise. I think it's laughter.
Yeah.
He snaps awake, and he's about to run across the street because the whole point of him sleeping on the not sleeping, but being on the porch was he was going to go intercede for mm-hmm. his neighbor. But he like gets to the door of his enclosed porch, and then he looks down.
muddy feet prints.
Little baby feet prints going into his house.
And he goes into his house and he's like, Gage? Gage? Are you in here?
Let's play hide and seek.
Gage? Are you upstairs?
Yeah. Okay. So he's following this baby laughter up the stairs, presumably with more muddy footprints.
Right.
He gets into his bedroom. He's like, I've got a present for you.
Gage is back and you're gonna be in trouble.
So he whips out a pocket knife and he's like, got a present for you. And I'm like, you're ready. You're really ready to stab a baby right now.
Yeah. And he goes over to, he checks underneath the bed. And then that's when Church comes down.
He's barefoot the entire time.
He's wearing like slippers, I think. But either way, his Achilles heel is exposed, and that is important.
He's distracted by the cat, you were saying, right?
Yeah, he goes to look under the bed, and before he can actually get a look under the bed, that's when Church, like, goes, meow, and, like, jumps out.
So then you see this little baby hand, and I think it might be a model, because I can't imagine them actually. Whenever the baby's actually doing something awful, it's like a dummy or something, and they cut away from it. There are some close-up shots where it's actually him, but you can tell if you know kids that he's just kind of playing.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that he says, you know, let's go play hide and seek is how a kid would say it. But if a guy behind you, again, breath on your neck, was like,
let's go hide and seek,
you'd be like,
I think we tried to do that at the same time and it didn't really work.
We could give it two different tries. You go ahead.
Okay. Let's play hide and seek. Sorry. Wow, that was bad.
You do.
Let's play hide and seek.
That was good. A lot better than.
There's lots of ways that you could have made it super creepy, but this little kid, he doesn't have a filter on his voice. They don't change the octave at all. It's just his little baby voice.
In the book, Gage doesn't say anything at all. He's just got like baby like coos and stuff because he's still pretty young in the book. So when he starts talking in the book, it is super creepy because he's saying some very coherent sentences and it's just sort of like, this is weird. This kid has never said these kind of coherent sentences before.
It's interesting because in the book, I think the baby is much younger. And the director thought that this baby, Miko, was so cute that even though between production it was he was 31 and 33 months old, that she was like, no, he's my guy. He's the cutest freaking thing I've ever seen. And she was right. Okay, so the baby hand extends, probably a model dummy hand extends and cuts this Achilles heel. And at this point, my roommate who had just been walking through the room was like, I was like, hey, this is the worst part. And the cut happens. He goes, ah, and she runs up the stairs. She's like, no.
It's almost like a saw going through a leg.
Yeah. Yes, it was there. Why we're seeing people lose limbs left and right in this podcast. The shocked part isn't always meant to imply dismemberment, but it doesn't hurt us. And applaud isn't meant to mock the mono-armed person who can no longer do that action unless they are the sound of one hand clapping, which I can do. That might just be one hand snapping when you close it really fast, because one hand clapping would just be like waving.
I call it one hand clapping. I've just tried to do that, and this is what I got.
Because you don't have stupid long fingers.
That's good. I also think my motor functions are so like minuscule right now. I don't know.
That's true. I do very little work. I do not have carpal tunnel.
Okay.
Achilles heel cuts are the worst. And he just lays there. His heel gets cut. He rolls over. The baby starts crawling up at him. And he's just like, I guess I'm going to die. And then when he lays there, it's only a makeup effect. So it's pretty interesting. The real kid, Miko, goes in for a bite. He's like, with his little face, and they only put a tiny amount of makeup on him to look kind of dead. And then they have the dummy pull away from the neck so you can't see the face anymore, but you see that there's like red smudge. That they never put actual blood on this baby. I mean, they didn't put actual blood on anybody, but they don't gore up this baby. I feel like through this entire film they really took care of this baby. And I don't think he was traumatized at all. Which is very nice. Okay, so the truck pulls up in front of her home and Rachel's home.
And she gets out and she looks back at the driver. Pascal shows up, she says thank you, and he says think nothing of it, and he has this big old smirk on his face. And the driver says, I really hope things work out. I hope your troubles work out. And she's like, thank you, I do too. She says, do you remember what she says? I remember what Pascal says. He says, I'm not, and then he closes the door.
Naomi. Naomi.
I'm sorry.
Naomi.
I know, you're gonna just have to edit this.
Sometimes silence is better. Sometimes silence is better.
Jonathan.